Tuesday evening share. The topic for this evening that was publicised as posthumous paternity and IVF for single women. I recognise that this is really quite a sensitive subject to be addressing, and I'm going to try to address it in a sensitive manner. It's a very important subject. I'm not going to be giving any piskei halacha in the course of a 45-minute shiur over Zoom. These are, you know, very big and serious issues. But what I'm hoping to do is to flag up what some of the halachic and hashkafic considerations are that's for, you know, people to ponder and perhaps for further discussion, either privately or in other contexts in the future. That's when I gave the top title for the share, I said posthumous paternity and IVF single women. That's when I started preparing it, I actually realised that it's best to present it in the other order and to speak about first IVF for single women and then the question of posthumous paternity. And that's because they're related sugyot for obvious reasons, and they're all to do with fertility and procreation. That's, and a lot of the principles that we establish in the first part of the discussion will be relevant in the second part of the discussion as well. I think everybody's on mute, but if you have any questions as we go through, then I think there's a wave function or something like that, or unmute yourselves or jump around or send a text or something like that. So the question of IVF for single women is a topic which was never discussed, certainly not 500 years ago in the times of the Rishonim, certainly not in the times of Chazal, and not even 50 years ago. But it's a phenomena and a topic which has been discussed in recent years, probably the past 5 to 10 years, not more than that. It's been on the religious agenda and a topic of conversation and discussion. That, and it manifests itself in two ways. That there are some women who simply don't want to get married but still want to have children. And there are other women who would very much like to get married, but for whatever reason, they haven't yet met the right person. They find themselves still single, that's as their late 30s and early to mid 40s are creeping up on them. They realise that they have a biological clock, and they want to make sure that they have children for all sorts of reasons that are understandable and that we're sympathetic to. And very often they want to know what is the halachic, correct halachic response, what is the correct religious response to this conundrum and this challenge that they face. The notion of IVF treatment and IVF conception that has been discussed by the halachists for about the past 50 years. That's obviously two generations ago it wasn't a scientific reality, but since it's become a scientific reality, it's become a point of halachic discussion. That's, I think somebody has their microphone on. Alan, could you perhaps mute everybody, and that might be the best way of dealing with it. So I want to actually ask a couple of questions before we look at some sources. That's the first question is technically, is it permissible to impregnate a woman that's using IVF when she's a single woman? Is it considered pritsut? Pritsut means illicit and inappropriate relationships. That's, or is it considered, you know, an acceptable way of conceiving a child? That's the first question. So is it permissible? Second question is, if it is permissible, what are the halachic implications of such a conception and such a child? So, you know, for example, the question comes up, you know, paternity. That who is regarded as the halachic father of this child? You know, what defines a parent halachically? Is it the genetic contribution that they make? Or is it perhaps a biological act that they've participated in? So is it, you know, for a mother, an act of giving birth? For a father, perhaps an act of impregnating a woman so that she will conceive? So, you know, what is the paternal relationship to this child? And that will have a number of associated questions with it. That's in its most simple sense, you know, question of, you know, kibud av va'em. And in a biblical sense, you know, if a person wounds a parent, then they're chayv mita. Is this regarded as their parent? There'll be a further question about relations. That's meaning that if a man has children in a normal manner and with one woman, and then subsequently has children with IVF with another woman, are those various children, are they half siblings, or are they not related to each other? And there'll be important implications there. And another interesting question which comes up and is discussed by the poskim is the question of yibum, and chalitza. If a person has a child through IVF, is it regarded as his child? That if he subsequently dies without any further children, will he, you know, be regarded as having died without issue or with issue? So those are the type of issues that you know, that come up. And then the third question I want to address, as far as speaking about IVF for single women, is if it is permissible, that, and when we've considered the halachic applications and implications, is it something which is desirable for society in general and desirable within the religious society? So those are the sort of the headlines for what I want to try and discuss. The response literature, that as far as this question is concerned, really only deals with the question of IVF, that's for a married woman who's unable to conceive in the normal way, and then the question of that first IVF with her husband and then IVF with a donor. But I want to start with a Gemara in Masechet Chagiga. So the Gemara in Masechet Chagiga discusses a very famous halachic case, which is the case known as Nit'abra Bambati. A woman who became pregnant, she conceived, not through a regular act of intercourse, but by bathing in water which had semen in it, which had been emitted by a man. And she bathed in that water, and she absorbed the semen into the uterus, and she conceived that way. Now, whether or not this is something which is really possible is actually of no interest to us. It's neither here nor there whether whether what Chazal believed in this case was physically possible is true or not. Because what it's doing for us is actually establishing for us some very important principles. And as a footnote to what I'm saying, I often feel that, you know, sometimes when you're learning Gemara, you come across, you know, a really bizarre situation. And you say, you know, did they really believe this can happen? You know, and the answer to my mind is very often no. They didn't necessarily believe that it happened, and it's totally far-fetched, and it's, you know, this scenario didn't happen. But what it's doing is it's giving us principles that we can work off and apply in other situations. So what we have here is a question about a woman who conceived and gave birth without a regular act of intercourse, but by absorbing semen from the bath. And the question is such a woman allowed to marry the Kohen Gadol? Why do we care if she could marry the Kohen Gadol? There's a specific din about the Kohen Gadol, v'hu yishaviv tu leha yikach, that the Kohen Gadol can only marry a betula, can only marry a virgin. And our question here is that is this woman's status as a virgin unaltered by the fact that she's conceived or not? And the conclusion of the Gemara is that in actual fact her status is unaltered. And the principle that this is laying down for us is that conception, that in a manner other than the conventional manner, that is not regarded as an act of sexual intercourse. And that's very, very important. That's, if we go back to, the first question that I posed, is the notion of IVF through a donor, would that be considered an illicit form of a relationship? And the answer to this question from this Gemara would seem to be that it's not regarded as an illicit form of relationship. That's because the woman's status is unchanged from being a betula, and it's regarded as an actual fact that she has had no relationship here, and in actual fact she hasn't had a relationship here. The fact that she became pregnant, that doesn't indicate that there's been any relationship here, and therefore there can't be anything negative about such a relationship, because there's no relationship that took place. That the Taz in Yoredeia that cites Rabbeinu Peretz. Rabbeinu Peretz was one of the Rishonim, and Rabbeinu Peretz flags up that a woman who's a nida and therefore not allowed to engage in intimacy with her husband and not allowed to share a bed with her husband is nevertheless allowed to sleep in his bed and on his sheets, even though there might be stains of semen on the sheets, which in theory she could internalize, and in halachic theory could lead her to become pregnant. However, Rabbeinu Peretz says that she shouldn't sleep in somebody else's bed, another man's bed, a man who's not her husband. She shouldn't sleep in his bed in case the sheets are soiled in the same way, and in case she becomes pregnant. And the Taz says, quoting Rabbeinu Peretz, what's the reason why she mustn't do that? It's because we would be concerned about who are the half-siblings of any children that might be born as a result of what's happened here. That's the concern that we've got. It's not that we would have here a problem of a nida. Of a mamzer. The fact that this woman is married to Chaim and she became pregnant from the sperm of Reuven, that doesn't make the child a mamzer. And it doesn't even make her regard her as being an adulteress. She hasn't had a relationship with Reuven. But the challenge would be that the children that she has would be assumed to be Chaim's children, but in actual fact they would be Reuven's children, and we're worried that maybe when they grow older they want to get married, they'll meet Reuven's children in the street or at a disco, and they'll fall in love and they'll want to get married. And in actual fact it will turn out that they're half-siblings and not allowed to get married. So what Rabbeinu Peretz is establishing for us that such a relationship is not, or such a method of conceiving is not wrong per se, that it doesn't create mamzerim, and it doesn't constitute an act of adultery, the children are related to the biological or genetic father. And there could be, further down the line, there could be complications as a result of that. And that's the point that we have to be concerned about. So these two sources would seem to suggest to us that IVF, conception through IVF, is not a significant halachic problem in its own right. And certainly in a case where the biological father is known, it shouldn't be a problem. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a tshuva, in Evin Ha'ezer Chelek Aleph Simon Ein Aleph, he addresses this question, and he cites that Taz, and says we learn from that, Taz, that we learn from that, Taz, that IVF is going to be permitted. And remember, he's talking about in the context of a marriage, that, and he's talking about a case where the husband is unable to father children, that, and he's saying it wouldn't be a problem to have children from a, from another donor. But what he says is, in actual fact, that you should always choose a non-Jewish donor over a Jewish donor. It always sounds a little bit counterintuitive. One would think that if one wants to, you know, have Jewish children, better to have both parents being Jewish. But in this instance, Rav Moshe Feinstein opined that it would be better to have the father being non-Jewish rather than Jewish. Why is that? Because in a halachic sense, that's a Jewish child is not related to a non-Jewish parent and their non-Jewish family. And therefore, that if this Gentile donor, that he could have fathered, 50 children through IVF, that's in the four corners of the globe. And it wouldn't matter if this Jewish child married married any of them. That's because they're not actually related to any of these children, because none of these children are related to the Gentile father, because there's no yichus, there's no family relationship. That, I don't mean in an emotional sense, I mean in a biological halachic sense, between a Gentile and a Jew. And therefore, towards the end of the passage that I brought for you here from Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says, "V'yachin yesh la'atir b'shatat gadol, umitztarim mod, b'shtokakam levlad." So in a case of shatat gadol, where it's really, you know, a desperate situation, and the couple are very desperate and very much want to have a child, that you can impregnate her with sperm from a Gentile. Now, based on this, it would seem to be that there should be no difference, really, at least in the what Moriv Rabbi Harav Lichtenstein used to call Bamishor Ha'ilchati Hatzaruf, that in the narrow halachic sense, there shouldn't really be any difference between that situation and the situation of a single woman who's been unable to get married and very much wants to have children. That's IVF won't pose a problem in terms of her having had any sort of illicit relationship. And if she's impregnated with the sperm of a Nochri, of a Gentile, then there won't be any potential problems of the children that she bears, that's marrying a close relation in the future, because they don't have any close relations other than through her, but not through the father's side. It should be pointed out that after Rav Moshe Feinstein published this tshuva, that lots of people weren't very happy with it, and Rav Moshe issued later a hesitancy about it. He said he still stands by the halachic integrity of the tshuva, and he still agrees that min hadin it's permitted, and there's no pgam to the child, and there's no disqualification of the child or anything like that. But he thinks really it should be avoided, wherever possible, and it's not something that he would promote in any sense. But that is largely for extra halachic considerations, which we'll go on to discuss. That's the question of IVF has been discussed by, you know, all of the Gedolei HaPoskim in the course of the past 30, 40 years. That's we don't have the time this evening, you know, to go through all of them. But I want to bring one or two that's alternate views to Rav Moshe's lenient position. That's Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, a very prominent halachic authority in terms of medical ethics, that he addressed this question in a tshuva, and he took issue with Rav Moshe from a number of perspectives. Number one, he said that he thinks that there could be a difference between that's a case where the woman is passive and the case where the woman is active or proactive in terms of conceiving. He says the classic case of Nitabra Bambati was where a woman, you know, was just having a bath. That's she's having a bath at the end of the long day. She didn't know that a man's semen had been deposited in the bath, and she had no intention of conceiving that way. In that regard, then it's not regarded, it's not considered as anything negative or any form of illicit relationship. But if she were to be active or proactive in this form of conception, then he posits, based on various readings, that he posits that in actual fact it could be an illicit act and that it could be prohibited. So in a case of IVF, obviously the woman is proactive in what's happening rather than entirely passive or unaware of what's happening. That's one observation he makes. He also makes a further observation. This is in the last passage. It's very interesting from our perspective. Of Matsati Bukovets Yashan Noshan. He says, he's quoting here from the Chida in the Birkei Yosef, Reb Chaim David Azulai. That's a Sfardi great of the 18th century. That's who says, I found in a Kovets Yashan Noshan, a very old collection, Kitav Yad Al Klaf, Mitshuvot HaRishonim, a manuscript on parchment from the Rishonim, Uvob Sakim Moharenu Ravainu Shlomo Milondon. So Rabbeinu Solomon of London, that's, I don't know if he was a United Synagogue rabbi or a Federation rabbi or an Adas rabbi, but Rabbi Solomon of London, one of the Rishonim, Katav, Eini Shayuchol Alichot B'yom Tvilata B'merchat Sherach Tzabo Bala. When a woman, the day this woman's going to the mikveh, that's when she's preparing for the mikveh, she can't wash herself in a bath where her husband has already bathed. Shema Titaber V'yehav Lad Ben Hanita. In case she conceives as a result of it, and then as a result, that's the child would be the child of a nida. That's being the child of a nida is something which is regarded as a form of pagam. It's not being a mamzer, it's not being born out of wedlock, but it's not an ideal situation. That's, and he says, so, okay, Rabbeinu Peretz says she can sleep on somebody else's sheets, on her husband's sheets, and, you know, that's if she slept on somebody else's sheets, that it wouldn't be a problem. But in actual fact, Rabbeinu Shlomo of London disagrees, and who's to say that we accept Rabbeinu Peretz over Rabbeinu Shlomo of London? So in actual fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, Rabbeinu Shlomo of London, that with all due respect to us Londoners, but he's an obscure, unknown Rishon, and we don't have to take too much. he's not a major halachic figure, as opposed to Rabbeinu Peretz, who is a major Rabbeinu halachic figure. In any event, what we have here is a machloket poskim as to whether or not IVF from a donor, that's from a non-Jewish donor, is acceptable, and the Tzitz Eliezer was very, very cautious about it. I think it's very relevant for us to see, though, the comments of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, one of the greats of Yerushalayim, wrote in Minchat Shlomo as follows. He says, "Atanu va'edin hazra malachutit minochri l'toku fashel Yisraelit." So I want to discuss now the question of IVF from a Gentile donor. So he starts off by saying, you know, it's I don't really need to go into too much detail about, you know, the negative aspect of this. This is really something which is not terribly proper, and it's not very nice for a frum Jew to be involved with. As the Sefer HaKinuch says. The Sefer HaKinuch says, "V'ein safik ki teva ha'av tzafun b'ben." The Sefer HaKinuch says that the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree, meaning that a person's character is defined in some way from the genetic makeup of the father. Vigamamru, and they also said, Ki holdat harabavanim hatchalatati emehamolid. That's people who have bad midot, it comes from, you know, from the outside, it comes from who the parent is. That's for Esha Shenachon laharchik min hakiyo, v'loladun klal b'davar she'achol chas v'shalom nigrom lahachnis zera mereim b'kerem Hashem Beit Yisrael. Says, you know, maybe we should, you know, not discuss this subject at all, because that's when you're having a conception from a, you know, an unknown Gentile parent, that's, you know, who wants to bring Jewish children into the world with those sorts of, that sort of background? It could be an Oved Avodah Zarah, that, you know, everybody tries to choose the father of their child, that's, you know, by marrying that a person who they admire, a person they think has, you know, good midot, is a good person, somebody they look forward to having as the father of their child. That's, you know, this is something random. You don't know who you're getting, what you're getting, or anything. It's, you know, perhaps we should just, you know, not discuss it any further. So that's Rav Shlomo Zalman coming at it from one perspective. But then he says something which sums up the sensitivity that Rav Shlomo Zalman was famed to have. Acheyotu v'shvil rov hanashim haba'ot lishol kach, v'hanuchonot lipu'ulazu. But seeing as most women who come to me asking this question about IVF, and he's talking about married women, harezu mamash elat chayim. This is a question which is really life and death for them. You know, it's really of the utmost importance to them. Because they can't have IVF from a Jew. That's ki afim lo nomad ki dvarin shavlad mamzer. That's even if we, you know, assume that from a Jew the child wouldn't be a mamzer. And that, he says, is a point of debate. We still got the concern that maybe two half siblings would end up marrying each other. That, so he says, seeing as Chazal haven't said it's prohibited, then we have to ask the question, you know, bottom line, is it permitted or is it prohibited? It might be undesirable, but we need to get to the truth of it. And I think this is, you know, a very, very important notion that Rav Shlomo Zalman's introducing us to, and very important for Morei Halacha, people who pasken Halacha. Very often, a posek will be asked a question, and there's two dimensions to it. You know, there's the recommendation that comes with the answer, but there's also the answer in its narrower sense. And sometimes you have to divide, you know, between the two in terms of, you know, is it mutter, yes or no? And then even if it's mutter, there might be advice that, you know, it's not a good idea. But at the end of the day, that's, you know, it's, you can guide people in terms of what's good and bad, and you can tell people what's right and wrong, as it were. That's, but you can't tell people what's good and bad in terms of what's, you know, what's good practice and bad practice. You know, people sometimes have to make their own decisions about. You can advise them, but you can't pasken for them. That's in terms of whether it's mutter or asa, that's, you can pasken for them. If a person comes to my house, that's, and, I know that they've got, terrible cholesterol and terribly overweight, and they're supposed to be on a very low-fat diet, and they see the cream cakes left over from Shavuot on my table. That's, and they say to me, "That's, are they milchik or parav?" Because they're fleishik. That's, so, you know, I can, you know, I have to tell them the truth that they're milchik. I can, you know, advise them not to, you know, not to eat it. That's, I can't paskin for them not to eat it. So Rav Shlomo Zalman's conclusion is that min hadin, IVF treatment from a Gentile donor is permissible. That's, he regards it as kior, but as something, really distasteful, but at the same time that he recognizes that for some people this is a life and death issue. So I think we've answered my first question: is it permissible? Which, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, it is. According to other poskim, it isn't. I think the Minhag HaOlam, that's 50 years after the first Tshuvot were written on this, is to rely on Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's and many people do go through IVF. That's with a donor, Gentile donor. That's relying on Rav Moshe Feinstein. Maybe some individuals want to, follow the stricter opinions, but I don't think I think Rav Moshe was regarded as being big enough, strong enough, and broad enough shoulders. That person who relies on Rav Moshe, that's well within the bounds of normative halacha. In terms of paternity, we've seemed to have established that if it's a Jewish donor, then the child will be related to that father. If it's a non-Jewish donor, then the child won't be related to that father, with all the various knock-on effects. So, in terms of Yerusha, that's if it's a Jewish father, so then the child is entitled, if it's a boy, the child's entitled to part of that that father's estate when the father passes on, etc. etc. So that addresses the second halachic point there. Jason has a question. Would a Jewish donor be allowed? That a Jewish donor would always be recommended against. That's one would always be recommended to look for a Gentile donor because it solves the halachic problems, especially as I think different countries have different rules and the legalities have changed, but till fairly recently, so I think it's changed in recent years, but till fairly recently that's it was always anonymous. That so you had no idea who the parent was going to be. So if it was in Israel, that's the assumption is probably it was Jewish sperm, but you had no idea who the parent was going to be. That's Rav Moshe says, Chutz La'aretz, you can assume that that it's from from a Gentile donor. That's in theory, if one were having the sperm donation from somebody that you knew, and you were going to tell the child, who his biological parent was, then it's then it would be less of a problem. But I think, bearing in mind, there are some views that hold that certainly with a married woman that it could be a problem of mamzerut. That's so certainly for a married couple, that's we'd always want to go with a non-Jewish donor. That's in a single woman it would be less critical, but I think we would still always want to go with that. How it works in Israel, I don't know. That's as far as that's concerned. So the third question is this something which is desirable? And for that, we have to look at it from two perspectives. Is it desirable for the woman in question? And is it desirable for society as a whole? So I'm going to make some observations here, which are not the gospel necessarily, and which some people might disagree with strongly, and some people might even regard as being being offensive. But I think they're legitimate considerations, and I think they're worth worth consideration. I think that in general for society, it's good that children grow up with a mother and a father. That both parents contribute something to the upbringing of their children. It's important that boys have fathers and that they have mothers, and it's important that girls have fathers and that they have mothers. That's as role models. And without having both of those parents, that's not a lachatchila. That's not a lachatchila for society. Having said that, You know, we look around the world, and there are many people who have brought up children by themselves very successfully. Those are in cases where marriage has broken down, or where a father has died, or a mother has died, and very often you see products of single parent families that who are emotionally stable, and anybody would be proud to have them as a child, and grow up as fine parents for their own children, and there's nothing, they haven't suffered in any way. So whilst it's, I think an ideal to have two parent families, that's not the only successful model that that exists. A further consideration which is sometimes raised is that it's you're at a disadvantage for many reasons if you've got a if you l'chatchila create a one parent family. So it's true that you don't have certain models of parenthood in the equation. On the flip side, that's I think we can say that there are not every two-parent family is a success, and on top of that, very often, this scenario would very usually be talking about an older single woman who's more mature in her outlook than a person who becomes a mother at aged 20 or 21. That will often be financially stable. They've been working for 10, 15, maybe 20 years already. That's they're able to give their child everything that's needed. They're in a position where they can take 2 years out of work to look after a child, etc. And those are considerations which shouldn't be poo-pooed. So I think as a desirable for what's desirable for society as a whole, that it's desirable that people are having children as a married couple. That doesn't work for everybody for all sorts of reasons that we understand. And I think the halakha can have some sensitivity towards people who, women who find themselves in those situations. I don't think we would want to create a norm by which, in a generation's time, that children can look around and say, "Well, listen, that's I don't want the hassle of a husband. That's I want to have more freedom in my life. I want to have children, and I have children through IVF, and that's a norm, which is one of the options on the table." I think we still want very much to promote marriage in society, both Jewish and non-Jewish society, as being an ideal. That's but recognizing that the ideals don't always work for everybody. That's and to have a sensitive and understanding attitude towards women who choose to go through down the IVF route. That's having read some of the contemporary rabbinate's comments on these matters, I think some of the comments are mistaken and misguided. There are suggestions made that it's a stigma in society to come from a single parent family, not to know who your father is, etc. That might well have been true a generation or two generations ago. For better or for worse, we live in a society where, certainly in the wider society, a very, very high proportion of children are very high proportion of children are not don't come from two parent families. And even in Jewish society, the family unit as we once knew it, that is not as universal as once upon a time it was. So I think we want to always be promoting that in an ideal world, every Jewish man and every Jewish woman should be able to find their partner together and bring up children that way. But we recognize that for some people it's not that ideal world, and everybody needs to make their own, you know, considerations at, you know, as to what's right for them, what's right for their commitment to society, etc., etc. But I think from a halachic perspective, it's a little bit difficult to say that a married couple can use IVF from a donor. But a single woman under no circumstances can. So those are some halachic insights and some hashkafic thoughts onto that first question. Let me move on now to the second question. And the second question was about posthumous paternity. So every now and then it comes up in the news that this can be one of two scenarios. Either somebody had their sperm frozen before they died. Usually it's a case where the person is ill, perhaps they've got cancer, something like that. They want to preserve their sperm so that their wife, or that's in the society that we live in nowadays, their partner, can have their child at some stage in the future. Occasionally it happens that the sperm is extracted posthumously. And the halakhic question here is it permissible to impregnate a woman with sperm from somebody who's no longer alive? That second question is that if it is permissible, is that permissible only with sperm that was obtained prior to a person died or even after they died? And then if it is permissible, what are the halakhic implications? So we've kind of touched on that, you know, in terms of that, you know, we've seen that a person is essentially related to whoever is they providing them with the biological makeup they needed. And then we've got the question again, you know, is this something which is desirable either for the individuals concerned or for the for society as a whole? So let's start, you know, just with the question of is it permitted? So it seems that it's taken as a given by most poskim that halakhically there can't be anything wrong with impregnating a woman with her late husband's sperm that was collected prior to his death. This was something that he passed over into somebody else's reshut before he died. And even if he hasn't passed it over into their reshut before he died, that once he died, it's inherited by somebody. You're not stealing it in any way. That certainly if he said that's what he wants to have done with it, then it's going to be permissible to do that. And as we've seen from the previous part of the share, that he will be regarded as the father of this child. With almost all of the implications. We'll come to an exception in just a moment. The big question is it permissible to harvest the sperm after he's died? That's the Gemara Masechet Avodah Zarah. Daf Kaftet tells us that meit asur b'hana'ah, that you're not allowed to benefit from somebody who's dead, and that's what the Rambam paskens as well. So here you've got a problem that the person's died, and then his wife is now extracting sperm that's to use it to impregnate herself with. So sometimes it's the parents, you know, will collect the sperm so that they'll be able to use it for IVF, and their son will have become a father. So this would seem to indicate that it's going to be prohibited, because you can't get hana, you can't get benefit from a dead person. There's a lot of discussion about this. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim in the 1940s and 1950s, a very important posek, he questioned this. He suggested in actual fact it might not be a problem of iso hana, might not be a problem of getting benefit from it. Why not? Partly because the quantity is too too small to have a halachic relevance, and partly because it's not derech hana'a, it's not the usual way in which sperm is used. One can argue that perhaps it is the usual way in which sperm is used. Sperm is usually used to for purposes of conception. So that's a point of discussion. Others would argue, no, sperm is usually used. That's for conception through sexual intercourse, and this is not through sexual intercourse. So really a machloket there as to whether or not it's permissible to harvest sperm after the person has died. I said there is an exception to the question as to whether or not this is the person's child in all regards, and that's with regard to the question of yibum. So if a man dies and he's got no a married man dies, he's got no children, that's his wife's not allowed to remarry unless she has either yibum or chalitza done for her. Now, what if this man's got no children before he dies? Subsequently, his wife is impregnated with his sperm and then has a child. Is this regarded as his child so that she won't have to have yibum or chalitza? That's a point of machloket between the poskim. The Noda Bihuda, very famous 18th century posek, the Rav of Prague, that was of the opinion that it doesn't count as yibum, or doesn't exempt her from yibum. She would still need to have yibum done. And he says there's a model in that halakha that we can talk about, that's for a woman becoming pregnant after her husband dies. And what about a man who has intercourse with his wife and then immediately after dies? That so he's had intercourse with her, but she obviously hasn't conceived. The conception hasn't yet taken place. That's and therefore he he died before conception. That's Reb Yitzchak Shmelkus, that's the author of the Beit Yitzchak, disagreed, and he said the other way round. That's and he was of the opinion that if you're a son in terms of Yerusha and you can inherit what belongs to your father, you can also exempt your mother from Yibum and Chalitza. It's a machloket in the poskim. Poskim Manenu seem to be of the opinion that it's that it doesn't exempt from Yibum and Chalitza. That's so what we've seen is that in a halachic sense, that certainly to use ready stored sperm is not going to be prohibited, but to use sperm that has been harvested after death would seem to be problematic according to many poskim. But as I say, it's a machloket in the poskim. But we're left still with the question of, is this something which is desirable? And again, I'm going to share with you my thoughts on the matter. People might take issue with them, but I think they're worthy of consideration. First observation I would make is that I think this is very unhealthy for the family involved. I think it's unhealthy for the woman who's going to be impregnated with her late husband's sperm. And I think it's bad for the rest of the family who want this to happen as well. In terms of the natural course and cycle of life is that people die and eventually family members move on from that trauma. And for every death, every relation has a different degree of trauma that they experience. And it's harder or easier for different people. But I don't think it's, I think the healthy way of, of recovering, however long that takes, is to be able to move on in some way. And I think a woman who wants to be impregnated with her late husband's sperm, that is not allowing herself to move on emotionally in the way that's going to be most healthy for her. I understand that a woman in that position might well argue with me and tell me that I'm being bigoted and that she knows what's better for her emotionally than I do. I understand that, but that's my thought there. The second consideration is that I don't think this is really the way to bring zechut to a nifta. That suggestions that have been made, that's by people who are, have undergone campaigns for this, parents who've wanted to be able to use their dead child's sperm, etc., is that this is a way of bringing zechut to their child, that they can, that they will have that they will father children and help procreate the world. That's a person who's passed on, chofshi min ha-mitzvot. They don't have to observe mitzvot any longer. That's, they've got no mitzvah pruravu. That's, there are lots of ways of perpetuating the memory of a person who's passed on. And it doesn't need to be through all the difficulties and the challenges of bringing a posthumous child, into the world. These are very expensive, procedures and legal battles usually. That's build a hospital wing, make many people better. Build a yeshiva, whatever it is, marry off orphans, whatever it might be. These are more conventional ways of bringing zechut to the nifter. I don't think they're any less powerful than producing a child for a nifter, for a soul which has no longer got the chiyuv of mitzvot. The final consideration came to my mind from a Gemara Masechet Brachot in the first perek, which talks about the prophet, the king Chizkiyahu HaMelech. That's, and the Gemara tells us as follows: this is Daf Yud Amud Aleph. Bayamim haim chalach Chizkiyahu lamut, vayavoy lav Yishayu ben Amos Hanavi vayomelo. So Chizkiyahu was on his deathbed, or what he thought was going to be his deathbed, and Isaiah the prophet came to him and said, Ko amar Adonai Tzavaot. So says Hashem, Sav leveitcha, instruct your household, ki meita tav lo tichye, you're about to die and you won't live. The Gemara says, the prophet said, Maiki meita tav lo tichye. The Gemara asks, well, what did the Navi mean when he said you will die and you won't live? Meitatab olam haze, you will die in this world, v'lo tichyel olam haba, and you won't live in the world to come. Amar lei, so Chizkiyahu said to the prophet, Maikulehai, why is it so terrible? What have I done so terrible in my life that I'm not going to live in the world to come? Amar lei, he said to him, Mishum dolo asat b'fri of Rivia, because you never wanted to have children. Amar lei, so Chizkiyahu said to him, Mishum dechazali b'ruach ha-kodesh, that's because I saw through ruach ha-kodesh, t'nafki minai benindulo malu, that my offspring wouldn't be good people. My offspring wouldn't be good people, and therefore I decided it was better not to have children. Amar lei, so the Navi said to him, Bahadei kavshid rachman alamalach, why do you have to get yourself involved with the secret ideas of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? You are a maita mifkadati bailach lemevad. Your job is to do the mitzvot that you've been given. And what suits HaKadosh Baruch Hu la'avit, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of. You worry about your things, HaKadosh Baruch Hu worry about his things. Amar lei, so Chizkiyahu said to him, Hashta havli barte. You know what? I hear what you're saying. I'd like to marry your daughter. Okay, so we don't need to go on to the rest of the sugya, but he did marry Yeshayahu's daughter. In any event, what we're seeing here is that Chizkiyahu HaNavi didn't want to have children because he believed his children were going to be not going to be good people. And the Navi said to Chizkiyahu that, no, you've got a mitzvah to do. That shouldn't be one of your considerations. Now, that's true in the case of that a person who's got the mitzvah Puriv Rivia, a person who has to have children. But a person who's dead doesn't have to have children. And that's those of you who've got children, those of you who haven't yet got children, I think we all know that bringing up children is partly a skill and partly a lottery, and very difficult to make sure that they turn out in the way that you absolutely want them to turn out. There are no guarantees in life. So if you've got a mitzvah, so you have to risk it. If you haven't got a mitzvah, why risk it? Why bring into the world children who might not be male, who might not you know, reach the aspirations that we should have for them. And therefore, I don't see, you know, a benefit from a hashkafic perspective or from a spiritual perspective in posthumous paternity. That's combined with the, you know, emotional consideration that I've expressed as well. So ad kan for this evening's share. That's I recognise that this might have touched a raw nerve or a difficulty for some people who might have been listening. And certainly I invite anybody who wants to discuss this with me, that's, you know, privately at any stage, you know, please feel free to reach out to me and, you know, make contact with me, and I'm, you know, very happy to give you, you know, my time and my attention to discuss this. That's this was the Evan Ha'ezer share. So next week we have the Choshen Mishpat share. That's Choshen Mishpat is the part of Shulchan Aruch which deals with civil law and business law and the like. And the topic that I want to discuss next week is to do with breaking contracts due to the coronavirus pandemic. We're all aware that lots of people have, in lots of ways, have felt it necessary or been unable to carry through with contracts, whether it's employment contracts, contracts for services, contracts for properties that they've wanted to rent, etc., etc. And I'll be sharing with you next week some of the halachic literature on that.